When you walk through the garden.
Welcome to a special series of podcasts by the Center for Emerging Media. I'm Mark Steiner. As we all anticipate the final episode of The Wire on Sunday, we're bringing you in-depth interviews with some of the creative minds behind the show. To the fans of The Wire, Clark Peters is better known as Detective Lester Freeman, a measured, exacting, and intellectual police officer. Probably one of the most honorable characters on the show. These days, Clark spends most of his time in London, working as an actor in the vibrant world of theater that exists on the West End. When he has a chance, he comes back to his home he bought in Baltimore. During the period of his life, he devoted to The Wire. The spacious row house became a hangout for the cast and crew. Many even moved in themselves during the season of filming, and I can understand why, as I stopped by to catch up with Clark one recent morning and fell right into the ease of his home. I started out by asking him about Baltimore. You kind of fall in love with this city, haven't you?
It's got so much potential, you know, and it's got history and it's got culture, you know, and there's a dark side. Well, there's when I say dark, I don't mean dark in a negative sense, but a dark as in the shadows, you know, of culture that is just not being hit. You know, the artist community around here, you mm-hmm. know, the painters, you know, I'm blown away with it. You know, my friend Larry Scott, who passed away this year, you know, that's Larry's. I've got a bunch of his stuff around here as well. And I'm just, you know, it feels like how I imagined my father's experience of Greenwich Village was back in the 50s, you know, where there was poetry and there was jazz and there was art. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that Baltimore's got that, you know, but I think it's in the shadows, you know.
In the shadows.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just needs to come on out even more. When Reggie was here, he was playing his Barry up on the balcony one day. And he's going over the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. And then one day I'm sitting here and I hear two horns. And there's someone across the alley, man, with a trumpet answering him. I'm thinking, this is it.
I love that.
This is it, man. This is it. You know? Oh, shoot. You don't get stuff like that anywhere else. It's just manageable enough as a city to have those kind of moments, you know, and just put a real nice atmosphere up. Yeah. Yeah, I dig it. I dig it.
You know, Bob Wisdom said to me once, about this stuff in The Wire. I want to come back to what you were saying, but I'm going to come back this way. Mm-hmm. Bob was said to me that one of the things about The Wire, he said, that blew him away was there's never been a place in TV, film, in America where so much black talent gathered in one place at one time.
Yeah. Yeah. That's very true. And subsequently, it made all of us sort of, and particularly the storylines, I just all feel like actors on a mission, telling a story that needed to be told. And although that first season you see a lot of black faces, that second season the subject matter moved to the docks and into a white neighborhood, you know. And David was right when he said, The Wire is the story of a city. It's not just about the Barksdales or about Avon, you know, it's about all the stuff that happens here, and bringing all this talent together was just was wonderful, you know. Just more of that, please, more of that, you know. Because of that, you know, we could have discussions like that here, you know, and have dinners around, you know, where we don't. It seems like as a community of black actors, we don't get a lot of time to exercise our intellect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. Yeah, you're always chasing either the gig, you know, or whatever. And so it was enriching, you know, having, you know, brothers and sisters here talking, you know, and it was history, it was politics, and it wasn't all about, oh, I'm tired of the white dude kicking my ass, and this, you know. It wasn't all that, you know, it was, it, and it was, you know, like, you know, somebody say, well, like, you know, Amsterdam, you know, yeah, that's a damn good idea. You could see how that could work, you know, in a city like this. And probably only in a city like this, because it's small enough and it's manageable enough to monitor something like that. You couldn't do it in, like, New York. You know, I don't think you could do it in Philadelphia because the cities are so big and sprawling like that. But, you know, for, like, here, you know, so having all that black talent wasn't just about the talent. It was also about all those minds coming together and from these different walks of life. You know, some from the Caribbean, you know, some mixed, you know, some Native American ties, you know, some African ties, you know, some with high school education, some with you know, with college degrees, you know, with everybody, you know, like mixing and rapping. It was a beautiful thing, you know, more of that.
Who lived here in the beginning? Who?
I got this from, I got this from the Johns Hopkins lacrosse, males lacrosse team. They were here, right? And when I got in, there was the American flag and Bud Light, things all over the naked women on it. It was like a frat house, you know. And the helmets out on the back and the paintball shots where they were shooting the rats in the back. It was all good. It was good.
Would you say that a collective, like a bunch of actors came and lived here in the beginning with you in this house?
Yeah, it was just a... actually, it was John Doman. It was Reggie Cathay and say Presbaluski, Jim Trufrost. So the four of us were here. Last year it was again Reggie, Neil, and Karen Thorson. You know, one of our producers who was here. Yeah. So there would have been a lot more had I been here to manage it even better. But like you know, I just. I'm an actor, I'm not that much of a landlord. And if you want to come and hang, you know, I'm up for that. You know, it'll cost you this much. Help out with the food and the heat and you're cool.
Well, that's good though.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what made me think, like, if I had next door, damn, I could really turn this into a nice thing. You know, a really nice vibe.
You just have to move those people out, right?
Well, you know, he's a nice kid. He's a Skiz. He's from Sri Lanka, and he's a hip hop producer. You know, and his mother is a teacher. I think someplace in Annapolis. You know, but
that's funny.
Yeah,
it's wild. Little corners we don't know about in this town.
That's really what wild. I dig about Baltimore.
Yeah, there's all kinds of stories here.
Yeah, that's you know? Right.
And that's part of what we've been talking about doing, the next step. Mm-hmm. Well, when you did, David and Ed were saying to me that the actors had a lot to do with who their characters were, mm-hmm. what they did to kind of bring them to the fore. And mm-hmm. and both David and Ed focused a lot on your character. They thought about your characters being emblematic of a what was right about the police and what was
yes
and in some senses you know it was like the kind of vision of Ed Burns in the sense of
mm-hmm. I asked Ed who everybody seemed to have a character to go to study, you know. Bunk does exist, and so Wendell could hang out with Bunk. You know, McNulty could hang out with anybody, you know. So I asked Ed one day, I was really feeling on the outside. I think this in the second season, I think, like, who is Freeman based on? And Ed's face dropped. He said, well, I thought he was sort of based on me.
So I thought.
That worked. That works for me, Ed. Because yeah, a lot of love to this brother. You know, a lot of respect for this man and what he's done with his life. You know, and respect for the path that he's trying to walk in this jungle of deceit. You know, to try to keep it straight. You know, and I think that you know when people level negative accusation at the Wire. I think that they're not looking at characters like Freeman who are trying to do the right thing. You know, like any of them, who are not corrupt cops, but are trying to maintain some virtue in this forest of thorns where it's really difficult to negotiate through. You know, and with Freeman's story being sidelined for 13 years and 4 months or whatever for trying to do the right thing, you know, those are the characters that I think we need to look at more than the Omars and saying, oh, it's really a bad light on our city, or it's, you don't just look at the negative side. Look at the people who are trying to do it and look at their faces. They're, you know, not every black person on this show is a bad guy.
What do you, I mean, the night of the Baltimore premiere, mm-hmm. you were there.
Yep.
And there was a demonstration outside.
That's right.
With some very angry black folks saying... Mm-hmm.
Saying, you know, don't black actors, what are they saying? Black actors, don't sell your souls to these white storytellers or whatever. You know, and my response to them was... Write the stories, brother. Write the stories. Yeah, if there's a black cat writing a story, I'll do it. You know, it has nothing to do with in their minds, selling out. You know, the blessing of David is that regardless of what clothes that soul is wrapped in, the stories that the man's telling... are stories that just need to be gotten out there. He's not doing it because he's a white dude that's trying to do this.
Right.
No, the story just needs to be told.
But to me, I'm really curious about your thoughts about that. I was going to ask Bob the same thing, and Andre, if I talked to him, is that the complexities of race in The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here you have some people in the black community upset about The Wire and the images it portrayed, people mm-hmm. say. That the majority of people who wrote The Wire were white.
Mm-hmm.
That portrayed, and the black characters were a spectrum of humanity mm-hmm. in that thing.
Yeah.
And how you took, how Simon and Ed took the question of honor and justice and living by a certain code. You could be a cop who lived or didn't live by the code. You could be somebody who's honorable or not honorable, who was a drug dealer, didn't make any difference. Mm. And I just wonder about the complexity of that. What do you think, how does that fit into your conception of film and acting and the portrayal and the world of blackness in our country and how The Wire was part of that?
Well, you prefaced that by saying it was complicated.
And yes, it's complicated. And it's really, I'm having a hard time even forming the question.
Yes,
it's so complicated.
Yeah, that's right. So let's start with this. The way that those of the fairer race look at those of the darker race, I think is... And vice versa is pretty much governed by our history, you know. And in one respect, you know, when we look at the history, and I say the history that we are taught here in America, and it's kind of myopic because, and I understand that it has to be for a nation to maintain its integrity regardless of whether it's true or false or however they look at the accidents that happened in history, you know, their interpretation of them affect us all, you know. And so trying to, as a black actor in America, trying to move in this world, carrying our history with us, you know, the pain as well as the guilt, you know, the anger as well as the forgiveness, you know. It's hard. It's something that you'll hit on for a while, but you have to push to the side because at this point in time, it's about this particular gig. It's about this particular job. The Wire allows us, you know, and some other pieces allow us, August Wilson's things, for example, allow us to access that history and to use some of that that American collective consciousness or work within that, to slowly move boundaries, break down barriers, change stereotypes. And it seems like as black actors, you got to find some way inside yourself to sometimes use these moments in a cathartic kind of way. The things that Freeman has said that Clark has always wanted to say, mm-hmm. Following the money, for example. If you're trying to deal with the drug problem, go to where the problem started. Follow the money. And if you follow the money, you might wind up in Annapolis. You follow it further, you might wind up in Washington, D.C. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But in the main, in doing that, there's a sort of unsaid collective consciousness that is sort of a white, this is the White House. This is the White House. And so, all of this is, affects how we either approach the roles or not. The reason why it's complicated is because we have in the black community people who are educated, people who are not, people who want to act because they want to be stars. They're sort of driven, mm-hmm. by ego. There are black actors who want to tell stories. Just want to tell stories. There are black actors who want to tell stories like The Wire. There are black actors who want to tell stories like Bamboozled. Even within the community, sometimes that stuff works for us and sometimes it works against us. For myself, not having been in America for a long time, when I came back, I was blown away by what I saw on television that looked like, everyone's saying, yeah, there's a lot of black actors working. I'm looking and I'm thinking, like, this is the stuff that I was told in the 60s was degrading to black people. Why did we take off Amos and Andy? When you have and it's with respect that I say this about Eddie Murphy, when you got Eddie Murphy being James Brown in a hot tub. Hello. You know what I'm saying? How can you talk about the blackface as being degrading when you can turn on most of the stuff that was coming out of the 80s and see that same thing happening, in the 80s when we were arguing about fighting as those things in the 40s and 50s. So it's so from one generation to the next generation, as well in all of this, makes it even more complicated how we're going to communicate some integrity and move the whole thing forward, not just for black people, for everybody. Mm-hmm. We've all got to find a way to accept that what happened in entertainment in the change of the last century is valid for today. If you cut that part of it off from yourself, what are you left with? You don't know where you're coming from, Those guys, Burt Williams was a blackface, but he was a mime. He was a mime. This cat did amazing things from what we're told. Billy Daniels, who did that old black magic, told me that this cat was fantastic. He was like the Marcel Marceau, in blackface. There must have been a reason why Siegfried said, yeah, you come here. Mm-hmm. Because he had the craft, he had the art. It wasn't just about, the rabbit foot minstrels with Ma Rainey doing, shuck and jive kind of vaudevillian kind of stuff. There was something beyond that, and it's something that, as black people, we shouldn't be afraid of, but when it's put against, when it's set within this collective consciousness of America, then yes, you can see how it's degrading. You can see how that works. But then if you take those very same faces and you go to Africa, you see the black face kind of motif, and you see the distorted body dances, and it has a different meaning. They're not doing any. You can see that they're not doing anything else except one's on stage at the Lafayette Theater in Harlem and the other one's in the bush in Uganda.
The lineage becomes clear at some points.
Yeah.
When you look at that.
It's you know, that question is really not only complicated, but it's loaded because...
It is loaded.
Yeah, you know, there's a where do you begin, you know, because this train is moving kind of fast.
and it's interesting that people like like the writers who created this, David and Ed,
mm-hmm.
this, they have a sense of where this country is going, their own interpretation of it.
Yes, yeah.
It's very much inside the wire.
Mm-hmm.
Their view of American capitalism, their view of
yeah.
of race in America, you know. But they're tackling it head on. They're not shying away from it.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, they're not saying, okay, we've done our black thing, now we're going to go do something else. Mm-hmm. They're not leaving it.
Yeah, no, it's because it's about America. It's about America. And, you know, the wire is now in Europe. You know, and the feedback that I get in Europe is really interesting as well. Because I get feedback from Africans who are living in England looking at blacks in America on the wire. Their point of view is completely different, you know, to the Englishman's point of view of the wire, you know. And to all of them, my answer is that the reason why this works for you is because there's something in your environment, in your community, that resonates true with the wire. The wire is not just Baltimore. The wire holds a mirror up to you and your city. You will find everything wrong in your city that you find wrong in the wire. And that's why you're upset. And that's why you're intrigued to find out about it. And that's what keeps you there. It's those storylines, you know, keep you there for sure. But the politics of what's happening with the mayoral or the gubernatorial race, hello,
right there
is right there. You know.
So now what about you? You said earlier you grew up in Englewood, New Jersey, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you made some reference earlier to your dad in Greenwich Village. Mm-hmm. So what about you? What about you? What about your family? What was your dad doing in Greenwich Village? How did you grow up?
All right, my father was a commercial artist. On that side of the family, they're all artisans of some sort or the other. His mother, I remember as a child, had a potter's wheel and a kiln in her basement in Brooklyn.
Really?
Yeah. His father was a master carpenter. So, you know, that's all of that, I think, fed my father. He won one of those, you know, drawing contests, which was to go out, and the prize was to go out to California to work with Disney, right? And he won that at a very young age, back in the 30s. He was born in 1923, so, you know, somewhere in the 30s, he wasn't even 20 years old, you know. The story goes that when they saw this black face, they gave him the second prize rather than give him the first prize. But I don't think that deterred my dad, right, who was an artist. It was just part of his life. You know? Grandma would rent out rooms in her house in Brooklyn, you know, to musicians to come and rehearse it. You know? There's some story floating around that side of the family that Charlie Parker was down there blowing in, you know, in Brooklyn, you know, just rehearsing. You know, what else he was doing, I don't know. You know, but like, so my father comes up in this kind of environment, you know. And the village at that point in time, you know, was like a cultural center for, you know, for all, when I say cultural, I really mean cultural, because you had European life coming on in, you had the history of blacks who haven't been there already. It was a village that seemed to be safe for artists, you know, to be whomever they wanted
right.
to be, you know. And so Pops is in that. And so we grew up, you know, we grew up with that, in that kind of environment, you know, where, you know, we were not listening to AM radio, you know, we'll listen to Django Reinhardt, you know, Big Bill Bronzy, the Dandridge Sisters, mm-hmm. you know, of course, you know, the mainstays, Ellington, Basie, you know, Ella, Stan Getz is coming on into the vibe, you know. So that was the music that was around the house, you know. So, you know, with all of us coming up in that kind of vibe, you know, when we get older, we kind of want to go where do pops get that, you know. So I was born in New York, but raised in New Jersey, but it was always, you know, trying to get back to the city, you know. And where we grew up in the city was next to where the Polo Grounds used to be, you know.
Uh-huh.
Out of where there's a Democratic congressman from New York who's in the same, you know, in the same project. I think he came out of there as well. I think that my parents always wanted to be in that kind of environment. When we moved from New York to New Jersey, we moved to Englewood, and Englewood has always been an artist's colony as far as from before Hollywood moved from Fort Lee to Hollywood, you know, only because it was so close to the city for those musicians' work, you know. So, you know, in our town, there was Dizzy Gillespie, Tito Puente, around the corner were the Adderleys, you know, Mickey Baker, and Sylvia Robinson around the corner. The Isley Brothers are there. Travolta's live over there, you know. Went to school with the Bennett's boys, with Daigle, with Tony Bennett's kids. So, like, this is our environment. This is how we just grew up. That's all we knew, you know, and that was Englewood, you know. What was your question?
I was asking about, I was just curious about you mentioned your dad in Greenwich Village. So I was just curious about how you grew up, where you grew up,
yeah,
and you know, and what influenced you as a young guy to end up where you are now.
Well, that it's all of that. It's all of that. It's all of that. You know, and I kind of also not, you know, I always sort of on my mother's side, you know, that's African and Native American from, you know, from Georgia, South Carolina. Coming up that route. So this mixture of two almost cultures, because my paternal grandparents were from Barbados, and so, you know, I grew up with not a buddy. It's more like, how you doing, mate?
Right.
You know, right. It wasn't an ally, it was a muse. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. Different. Those are just, you know, it was till later on I thought, oh.
And I didn't know that you'd. I have to apologize because since I was reading about this, you wrote Five Guys. Name Mo. Oh,
yeah. I'm working on another one right now because this is the centenary of Louis Jordan. So the BBC have asked me to put something together for him over there, which is what I want to talk to you about again.
That's phenomenal.
You know, because...
I love Five Guys Name Mo, by the way.
Yeah.
I saw it in the city when it was on. And I just, you know, and the fact is, wow, you wrote that shit? I didn't know that. Well,
I could have stick five chicks with them and call it N5 Mo. Yeah, but we got to get more of Louis. It was my first foray into writing anything, you know, and it was a blessing that it came up like that, you know. I knew that people wanted to party, but I also wanted to do... I had done a series of these things in London, you know. I worked with my mentor, whose name was Ned Sharon, who passed away in the beginning of October of last year. And Ned brought to America, that was the week that was, right? I mean, he was a satirical writer, you know, Oxford, Cambridge educated,
right.
You know, really establishment, but always, you know, just a little bit sticking his foot in the establishment's butt, you know. And he being my mentor also opened up new different ways to try to do, to celebrate Louis Jordan's life, you know, or rather than saying, and then he wrote this and then he did that, it was more about just trying to get the persona of Louis Jordan as this fun-loving musician who had all these little anecdotes that are set to music that would address any situation in your life. You mm-hmm. know?
So what? How did you end up in London? How did you go from a young guy who wanted to be in the arts, come out of Englewood, New York, end up in London?
Well,
an expat.
Well, if you're that young person that wants to get into the arts and particularly theater. Even for America, you know, the roots of theater are in London, are in England. I was in Paris before that. I had gone to visit my brother who moved to Paris in about 68, I think. He was at Goddard College and he went over there to do some research on Isidore Duncan's brother, Bernard, who was an artisan. Again, artisans. They just move in our family. And he never came back. So in 71, I was asked to, if I'm going to go to Paris, make sure I bring Tony back for Thanksgiving. He was doing the show Hair in Paris, and I had been auditioning for it here in America. I didn't know T was in it when I was auditioning for it. I auditioned in New York, in Washington, in Boston, in San Francisco. It was just like, they saw me coming, it was like a laugh. Hey, here comes Clark. Hey, bring him on in. Watch this audition. You know, but I got over there, you know, and something happened where my brother didn't show up, and I walked on stage and took his place, you know. And so that was my first professional
gig. That was where? That was in?
That was in Paris.
That was in Paris. Right?
While I was there, I had met Leroy Wiggins and Tyrone Scott, who were both in the companies and worked with Motown backing singers and all this kind of stuff over the years. And they had actually come to England before, and before I did, or it was actually on their invitation that I came to England to just demo a song. Well, I come and we demo this song, and I swear it was like a film where David Platts, who's the head of Essex Music, was leaving the bathroom and heard us rehearsing and asked who they were. They just demoed a song. Well, why don't we see what we can do for them? And in 2 weeks, the last thing in my mind was thinking about songwriting. I had signed a songwriting contract, a publishing contract, a recording contract, and now I'm a recording artist with a group in Paris, in London called the Majestics.
Oh my God.
You know. Uh-huh. So we stayed together for about 3 years, and when that group disbanded, I went right back into theater, and I didn't move from that because that's what I wanted to do.
Theater.
From the very beginning.
And I've noticed that when I was reading a little piece on you yesterday, just it was very short, and that's where I saw the Five Guys Named Mo thing that actually Justin sent over to me. It was interesting. When I looked at your theater work in London, and I looked at your theater work in America, maybe I have this wrong, my first impression was that the theater work in London was almost non-racial, colorblind. Your theater work in America seemed to be mostly black.
That's right.
That struck me as I looked at that.
Well, yeah, it's I wish more people could see that, because what that indicates for me, or one way to look at that as a type of barometer for theater and the arts, is that theater is a part of British culture. Theater being, you know, the craft of storytelling, you know, is a part of British culture. It's educational and it's entertaining. It's part of their culture. In America, it's a commodity. It's not part of our culture. It's a commodity. And so I, as a soul wrapped in a black body, become that commodity on that particular shelf. All right, so if you want that, let's get that from that shelf and put it there, because those are the components that this country looks at, because it's a commodity. Whereas in London, you know, I'm playing Skye Masterson.
Right.
Opposite of a white Sarah. You know, unheard of. You know, I'm playing Daryl Van Horn, you know, in Witches of Eastwick. You know, to have a black devil in America will send all other kinds of things. To have a black devil in England is just, so what? He's playing the devil.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So it's nuances like that in the arts that keep me there. You know, allows me to go ahead and just play. It's about theater, and that's why they call it a play. Hello. It don't get much simpler than that. You know. So even coming back here, you know, that, you know, I do find it hard to get back into this racial mindset. You know, it doesn't make me any less politically aware of what's happening or with black people here in America. It doesn't mean that I have to just do black jobs. I'm going to continue to try to keep breaking down these barriers here in America, because they need to be broken down. You know, I have spent time in Africa. I know what Africa is about. I'm not a black person in America saying I'm an African American and have never stepped foot off of the block. You know, I'm coming to it with an enormous amount of experience as to who and why I am and where I am here. You know, but it still is a drag to just have to play the black parts, you know, or to hear like that. And having said that, you know, I did this film called Mona Lisa with Neil Jordan, and I put it to Neil at that point in time. I said, you know, I don't want to play another pimp. I'm tired of doing this, because those are the kind of roles that I was getting that were beginning to come to me in England. And this particular one was one that was nasty and insidious and evil. And at the end of the show, it was written that he just disappears into the night. And I put it to him that, hey, you know, a cat like this needs to be squashed, right? So they changed the ending of that, you know, to have this black criminal killed. Well, I didn't shoot another film for 10 years.
You did not.
I didn't, you know. And I can't, you know, and nothing was said about it. It's just that that's how things went, you know.
And I was thinking, it makes me think of the character just in The Wire, Lester Freeman. Mm-hmm. He was probably the most deeply intellectual character in the whole ensemble of characters.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I really liked.
Me too. Me too. You know, when I was saying earlier that he allowed, Freeman allowed Clark to say things that he probably would not normally have the platform to say, you know, or to behave in a way, you know, mm-hmm. And what was good about Freeman for myself is that he had all the exposition. He's the cat that explained things. He explained how to do the research to find out where the money is, you know. He's the cat that said, take a look at that nail. That nail is different from that one over there. It's nice being that character because for myself, I had to understand what Ed and David were writing in those first couple of seasons about breaking down how these things work, how the wiretap works. You know, and what they do, they just can't fabricate it. It's got to be legitimate, you know. So I'm learning through the process as well. Before I did this, you know, if someone said follow the money, I wouldn't know where to begin. But because I've had to explain to Sidnor and to the other youngsters how to do that, or because Freeman had to, now Clark knows it.
Uh-huh. Well, that's part of being an actor, too. You learn a lot as an actor.
Yeah.
If you really do it right, you learn a lot as an actor.
You will learn it.
You learn a lot. His character was the embodiment of intellect and integrity.
Yeah. And that's a blessing. I thank God that I got that role, you know, in that respect, because I think that it's... that's what I think being outside of America and coming back to it allows me a certain viewpoint or vantage point to view from on how to celebrate mm-hmm. these kind of people, you know, and how important they are. if he gets angry, it's because he's got a really good reason to be angry. You know, there used to be a time when people would fight to solve their differences. Now they just take out a gun and, you know, that's the end of it, you know. So life becomes cheap. But for Lester, life is very important, you know, and the quality of your life is very important, you know, and it's really for all of us to get this machine called America working properly. You know, that's Lester's. For Clark, this thing called America is something that has been sold to the rest of the world, and it's a damn good idea because the rest of the world wants it. But we've got to get it right in order to make sure that the product that we're selling, you know, has the integrity that we say that we say it has. You know, and it's not easy. It's not easy to manage a nation of what 300 some odd million people. You know, you know, it's nice having Warren Lester, and to have. To be attributed with his intellect. His intellect is not Clark's intellect. I'm an actor, you know. But he's opened up my eyes, you know. And I have friends now because of that who can, you know, help facilitate some of the changes that are necessary, you know, whether it's Baltimore, whether it's up and down this whole Eastern Corridor, with the drugs and the gangs and all of that kind of stuff, you know, that... there's not only diminishing and neutralizing our community, it's having a knock-on effect to other communities around as well. You know, so it's not always just a racial thing. You know, sometimes people say it's a racial thing. Most of the time, I think it's more an economic thing that has a sort of racial cover put on top of it. The problem is economic. You know, the problem is education. And when those things are addressed properly, or not even just seen to be addressed, but are actually addressed properly, then I think, you know, then I think we wind up living the American, we can live the American dream properly. Because right. You know, there'd be no reason for anyone to be angry unless it's just your own shit that you're carrying with you. You know, and it doesn't matter whether you're black, white, a Native American, Indian, or from an immigrant from Europe, you know.
I agree. Yeah. You know.
You've heard about the film, The Wire?
They're making a movie, The Wire?
Well, I'm putting it out there.
I like the idea.
Well, it was sort of being floated around last year, you know, because it seems like it's so popular, you know, that, it could easily, you know, go in that direction. What the storyline would be, where it would go from here, it can't be episode, you know, it can't be season 6, you know, it has to be an entity unto itself that addresses all of this stuff again, you know.
So there you have it. A Wire movie? We'll have to see. I wrapped up my conversation with Clark and left his Charles Village row home as his mother came downstairs to start her day. They shared a long and a deep hug as she made her way to the kitchen for a cup of coffee. Check out our site tomorrow for the next installment in our Wire podcast series. I'll be speaking with Andre Royo, we all know as Bubbles. You're listening to a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're assisted by engineer Andrew Epic. And thanks to Clean Cuts, Music, and Sound Design for studio space. To learn and hear more, go to our website at marksteinerblog.wordpress.com. And I'm Mark Steiner, the Center for Emerging Media. Take care.